Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Phileas Club. This show is the place where we gather from different parts of the world, talk about the things that have been happening in the past few weeks, and tell you what we think of them with our own perspectives, our own backgrounds, our own cultures, and hopefully you get a little bit of a different view on things that you might have thought you knew everything about. Or maybe we just confirm what you thought, and that is possible as well. We try not to have a bias in any way. I almost said we don't have a bias here, but I guess we all have a little bit of a bias. The important thing is to be open to listening to the other people's views on things, and that certainly is what we do here. My name is Patrick Béja, and I'm very glad to be welcoming back to the show. Let's first to my, if I was in France, so I'm from France and I currently live in Finland, and if I was in France, I would say to my east is Matthias joining us from Germany. So welcome, Matthias. How's it going?
Hello, neighbor.
But now you're down south. You're completely below. So I don't know where to look. Yep. How's it going?
We are a huge community. Everyone is a neighbor. So,
yeah, absolutely. We are in the European Union. We all love each other.
Yeah, but at least until this corona thing hit, because now we are all more or less enemies because we are closing the borders. No one can travel. And old rivalries are popping up again, I guess.
Well, we'll see. We'll discuss all of this and how things are going in this post-lockdown, partial post-lockdown, depending on where you live. Things are starting to change back a little bit, but we'll discuss that in a little bit. Before we do, I do want to welcome Dan Campos as well from Mexico. Mexico, is that the right way of saying it? How's it going, Dan?
Excellent, Patrick. And actually, you are using an accent that it's indistinguishable from somebody from Mexico. So that's a perfect pronunciation.
Yay! I love having great accents. We've had a standing debate on DTNS, a tech show I do with our good friend Tom Merritt, about whether or not I have a French sounding accent. I think I do have an accent, but I don't think people can tell I'm French if they don't know. But at least if I show up in Mexico and I say Mexico, then people, if I only say that word, people won't know where I'm from, or they'll assume I'm from there. So
they will perhaps think that you are an advanced French student who is just from Mexico and actually care to learn some different languages. So there you go, Patrick.
Thank you very much. So I think, Dan, we're going to start with you because I don't know anything about what's happening in Central South America and, well, specifically Mexico. Before we do, though, I do want to thank the people who support the show on Patreon. This show is a labor of love, and it's definitely a labor. It's a lot of work to put together, a lot of work to do, a lot of work to produce. So if you enjoy it, if you get something out of it, as I always say, please do consider supporting it on Patreon. It's super easy, takes literally 2 minutes. You go to patreon.com/thePhileas Club. You have the link in the show notes, and you can just give a buck or two per episode, and that is all that is required for the show to function. So if you like it, if you appreciate it, if you get something out of it, please do consider giving a little bit of your hard-earned cash, if you can. If you can't, then obviously I do not want to take your money. But if you can afford it, it would be absolutely awesome, and I would very much appreciate it. So patreon.com/thephileasclub. You can do it from your phone. You can do it from your computer. It takes 2 minutes, and it makes the show run. So yeah, we're going to go as usual. Each one of us is going to tell us about, tell the world about what's happening in their country. And what's the biggest piece of news, or I guess in these coronavirus times, what's the general atmosphere in Mexico, Dan? Let us know.
All right. I will start first perhaps some kind of funny news. And from there, I will take to the more current news. And this is actually kind of relevant because it reflects the kind of caution, the kind of care that some people at the current administration with our president are taking care of these different situations. Specifically, last week, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, our current president, tweeted a link from one of the projects that he released when he was first elected. That was in 2018. And the name of the project also was Proyecto 18 or Project 18 because it began in 2018. So he was just like thinking, okay, this will be a good moment because it's about 2 years from when we released this plan. So let's promote this. The only problem that was in there is that his people didn't care about renewing the contract with the domain. So somebody also got there first. And they registered on that domain a porn site.
Which oh, was, my God. Well,
Project 18, because you have to be 18 oh, or older to get there. And it was porno mexicano gratis, Mexican porn for free. So the people who is in charge of the social networks for the president and for those who are related to him, like this energy secretary or the, well, all the secretaries and ministers were retweeting because it was like, okay, this is good news from the president. Let's show the people how we are advancing in this. But nobody cared for check for the link and Twitter. And also, if you saw the tweet, you could see the web address, which is the same, but you could see the preview of the site, so nobody cared about that. So for about half a day, between 4-6 hours, everybody was like trolling the president and the ministries because they didn't pay attention to this.
How can you
so
not
that's the
like
first news?
How can you not at least like see the preview on the tweet for six? Like if you tweet it and after a couple of minutes you see, you know, people letting you know, and I guess maybe these public figures get a lot of tweets so they don't even pay attention to the responses, but at least a couple of, you know, direct messages or even someone calls you. It took like 6 or 7 hours for them to realize. That's terrible.
Yeah, and actually that shows because, for example, for the regular communications, if I could define the current president, he's kind of a mix between some of the worst aspects from Donald Trump and some of the worst aspects from Nicolas Maduro from Venezuela, where he, as Donald Trump, he tries to establish the agenda for the day. If somebody wants to, I don't know, confront him or talk about something else that he is not in his personal agenda, he just pretty much wants to change the subject of the conversation. So they actually really don't care about what somebody else is saying. And this is one of the main problems that we have in here because one of the main aspects that has been a common aspect in this administration is that if you are not in the side of the president, if you are not in the side of the so-called left in Mexico, and I say that it's the so-called left because it's more like evangelical right, but a lot of people think that because it's not a Catholic right, because, well, in Mexico, mostly of the people is Catholic, they think that because it's not Catholic, it's left, but they are more conservative in a lot of aspects. So if you are not in the side of the president, you are a conservative, you are somebody who shouldn't be taken into account. So we have this kind of division, which is really hurting us in different aspects. And this actually explains part of the way that they are doing the communication. So you have pretty much the official message, and if you have to be aligned into the official message. Hey. If you are not agreeing, you will be, as I mentioned before, you will be ignored. But also, Obrador established something that it was actually, he established when he was the city mayor in Mexico City. We call it the mañaneras, which are the morning conferences with, where he spends about an hour taking questions from the press, from a lot of the different representatives. And also he deals with the most important things that we have in the country. Right now, obviously, it's the coronavirus pandemic, but he uses it more like propaganda. And this has to do with what I mentioned before, because if you dare to challenge him with even with official information from the government sites, for example, the number of people suffering violence, No. You are wrong. I have a different set of numbers. That's always the response that he's going to give you. He always have a different set of numbers for anything that it's against the official position, even if you quote perhaps the numbers from an official page from the government and says, well, these are actually your numbers. And this has happened a lot of times. So this is like personal vision that they have in the government. Moving it to some of the things that we are dealing right now, we have something that is called the working street light or semáforo de recuperación, which indicates, according to the light that we are, which sectors of the industry are going to be opening after we recover from this pandemic disease. And I want to mention something before getting in there. That in Mexico in 2009, we have, we could say, a test trial and with not all the features available for the coronavirus, because we have the AH1N1 pandemic in here, this kind of disease that was kind of similar. Obviously, it wasn't as deadly as the coronavirus, and it was similar in the kind of the infectious level. And I remember very well that in 2009, the administration that we have in there took care and it was criticized because for a lot of people, they overreacted with the kind of infections that we have in here. The administration at that time, they decided to go all the way because it originated in Mexico. And they were thinking, well, if this is like something that originated in China, what the SARS virus, MERS virus, any kind of those other deadly diseases, we have to take a lot of attention because if it is associated with Mexico, obviously the industry, obviously the people who want to invest in Mexico will think twice before getting in there. So that's why they overreacted. But I remember very well that at that time I was working in an office in one of the main sectors here in Mexico. And I remember that we were made to wear face masks for about a month when you were getting there. I remember that in the city center, right in downtown, in front of the Fine Arts Palace, El Palacio de Bellas Artes, there were trucks from the military, from the army, delivering face masks. They were delivering also a lot of tests, to check if you were infected with this disease. And we had about 15 days, 1 week for complete lockdown, 2 weeks with a lot of 2 weeks of paying a lot of attention, and about a month where it kind of normalized the situation. And
you're still talking about 2009 now. Happened then. Okay.
Yeah. Sorry about that. At that time, we had this experience, and some of the lessons that we had to have from that situation was, okay, you have to pay more attention, to wash more your hands, you have to cover when you sneeze. At that moment, we call it the Dracula or the vampire sneeze, because you have to cover, like if you were wearing a cape, your face while sneezing. And other thing is that at least for 15 days, if you went to the city center, it was there were not a lot of people, and it was really sad, and the economy stopped for a bit. So it wasn't as serious as the current situation that we have, and that obviously is a worldwide situation, but those were some of the lessons that we had, and we didn't learn. When the current president came into power, one of the first things that he did was cutting the budget, because for him, something that means money, it's something that means corruption. And if you earn a lot of money, probably it's because you are corrupt. So he started cutting the salaries from the people at the top in the government institutions. He cut the budget of the health sector by half. It was like for about 46 or 49%, which is a lot. And that was 2 years ago. And when the current pandemic came here, it was kind of ridiculous because the same poster was present in here. Because he was saying, well, okay, yes, because we were doing austerity measurements. We were cutting the budget because a lot of money was just getting there and it wasn't getting to the people who actually need it. But one of the main problems is that the budget that he cut, it was the one in charge of the health of a lot of people. I mean, pretty much the entire country. So when we have this situation, the people who is fighting the pandemic in the hospitals, they didn't have the budget for the most essential items like face masks, like all the stuff that you need to cover and to protect yourself from getting infected. And after that, the president actually commented, well, you know, if you are a doctor, you are responsible for the health of the people who are coming to you. So you should take part of your salary and buy those things because even if I don't give you the money, you are responsible for that people. So for him, it's always somebody else's problems. And if you have money, pretty much you are in the wrong side of the equation. This is pretty much part of the things that have been facing here. Sorry, go, Patrick.
So when did you, let me ask you a couple of basic questions. When did, I guess, the country realize that things were going to be their drastic measures were going to be needed, and when did you get into lockdown? I guess you are into lockdown. For us in the Western world in general, it was early to mid-March that it happened everywhere at the same time. Was that also the time frame that it happened for you?
It is kind of similar because the way that we are located, and as you know, we are close to the United States, and a lot of works depend on of the United States. Even though we knew about the situation in Spain and Italy and in China, for us it was like, as long as it doesn't affect one of our main partners, in this case the United States, we can pretty much ignore that. So for late February and early January, we were already having daily communication from the government about the situation with the infection, but they were saying this is not important. They were saying, don't worry, just kind of pay attention, but we can pretty much go ahead. Even the president was like, you know, you have to go out and buy food in the mom and pop's restaurants. You have to go because the economy needs you. You have to go outside, even though the health secretary and the health subsecretary, who is who actually gives the information, we have a daily program at 7 p.m., which is not a soap opera, but this is where they release the official information. He was already recommending that we should be into a lockdown. A lot of businesses decided to go before the federal indication, the federal instruction from the president was being done. So by
so
early
when did that
March,
happen? Yeah. Okay.
In early March, it was when a lot of business were like, you know what, we have to stop here. We are going to start establishing different schedules. And if you can work at home, you will do it. At least for a couple of weeks, the official posture was, don't worry, you have to go outside. The official posture from the president, because even the health secretary was saying, you have to pay attention to this, even though it's not worry. By mid-March, it's when we started with the official lockdown. However, in early March, some of the state governors, like from Jalisco and Nuevo León, they decided to go before the instruction from the federal government. Mm. And those are some of the states that actually have the least cases of infection.
So I guess you basically your timetable is similar to, and I might be a little bit purposefully provocative here, but for you seem to be pretty antagonistic to the way it was handled, which I completely understand, and it seems there were some serious failings as everywhere. But I guess my point is the timetable is roughly similar to every other Western countries. Everywhere it was early March, people were like, woohoo, let's go out, let's support the economy. And then suddenly within the span of 10 days, everyone was saying, you should all stay at home right now. And let me turn to Matthias for just a second to go back in time again to that far, far away time of late February, early March. Germany seems to have done really well, or I don't know if we can say really well, but the one of the best handlings of these of this crisis. When did people really wake up to the importance of the crisis, and when did the lockdown start? Is it also that same time period of early to mid-March?
About the same time, but I think if you're asking me when people realized that it happened, for Europe at least, the key point is there was a Austrian ski resort, Ischgl, and a lot of people who went there to ski in around February got the coronavirus there and spread it all over Europe. So that's the key point when it all started, and from there it spread all over. And people
But that's when we look back. That's when we look back. We didn't realize at the time that it was happening.
I'm just thinking, because that was in late January, mid-February maybe. And then there was a carnival here, and there was an incident where an infected couple really wanted to go to carnival, and they went there and infected like half of the people over there. And that's when the point they realized, well, okay, this is serious. This is not just something in China. This is here now. So it was around the same time, I guess.
Yeah.
But lockdown happened afterwards.
Right.
Yeah, well, it wasn't really a lockdown in that sense. It was just the restrictions. We could still go out here. It's not as bad, for example, as in Italy, where people are literally confined to their houses, can't get out. Over here, you still can get out. You can still get to work. You can still go out to do some sports. You can still buy your groceries and everything. You just should avoid doing anything besides that, so you don't visit friends or go out to party or something. So it's not a lockdown is the wrong word, actually, because it sounds worse than it actually was over here.
Well, I think, yeah, I think that's how we define it. I don't know how stringent, how severe it is in other countries, but it was pretty much the same in France and Finland as well. It was, you had to stay home, but of course you could still go out to buy food. And most people, I mean, many people would make a lot of use of delivery stuff, but you shouldn't go out for work unless you absolutely had to. And we have these authorizations that we talked about, I don't know, back in February or early March. I apologize. I don't remember the first name of the Italian gentleman who joined us at that point, who told us about, I think it was either Alessandro or Giovanni, who told us about that authorization you had to fill to go out, even though it was just yourself who was filling it and was always valid. You would just fill out a document to help you think, do I really need to go out? Did you have something like that in Germany as well, Matthias, or not at all?
No, not at all.
Okay.
If you're sitting, there were incidents where people were sitting outside on park benches, and in the beginning, police would come over and say, why are you sitting here? Go home. But you didn't have any, you have to have any papers or permission slips or anything. You could just go out, and they were just looking that people were not actually walking outside in crowds. So if you're the member of the same household, for example, if you go out with your wife or your husband or your kids, that was okay. But if it was like a huge group, the police would intervene and say, please disperse for infection prevention.
Okay. All right. So roughly, I think we'll get to this in a little bit, but I think in Germany, things were handled probably the best out of the Western country, or in the best, in the top three of the 20 or 30 or whatever Western countries. But date-wise, it was very similar in every Western country and in at least Mexico. Now, the handling of things might be different. You seem to be saying, Dan, that things were not handled properly at all. I wonder what was put in place. Like, did you have that authorization paper that you had to fill out if you wanted to go out? How did things go? And more importantly, even, where are things now? I think that's what I want to know the most. How are things going now? Where are you in the evolution of the pandemic?
In the federal level, which covers pretty much like the entire country, except in the states where there are making exceptions, you don't need like a permit. So if you want to go out and, I don't know, buy stuff, you can do it. There are different businesses that are closed. Pretty much the only business that can be open are the, those that are considered essentials, which are things where places where you can buy either food or medicines or something that it's, as the name implies, something that you need to live. If you are not working in any of these business and you can work at home, well, you are blessed because you won't be getting exposed. Things like public transportation, they start closing some, for example, in Mexico City, some of the subway stations so that a lot of people wouldn't be able to get into the public transportation, so that you will be starting to apply in certain filters. So if you don't have as much as many people in the subway, well, the chance for getting infected are going to be less.
Of course.
The thing is that, well, it doesn't work like that because you have less trains working, you have less stations open, so you have more people in each station, and it's something that I have to deal with at least twice a week when I have to go physically to my to work. So it didn't work as planned. The public transportation is almost about getting in the regular schedule. They close for about 2 or 3 weeks the stations, as I mentioned, but they are reopening a lot of them. Last week, the government released the schedule for reopening the industries. So we are thinking that until mid-August, we will be getting to the end of this quarantine. And they released this information last week with something that for me it was kind of a red flag, because the president announced, well, you know what, we have already flattened the curve, so we can be thinking about opening different parts of the industry. Okay. When he announced that, we had 151 people dead on that specific day for coronavirus-related diseases. And the very next day, it actually went to 300. Yesterday, we have reported 501 people dead for coronavirus. But there's the other part of the problem. If we are comparing Mexico with the rest of the countries that are part of the OECD, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, which we are part, we are actually one of the countries that are making less tests. And if you go to check the acts, the official papers, when they say the cause of the death of the people, at the beginning we were actually joking because coronavirus wasn't something deadly. You should be worried more about atypical pneumonia, because most of the people who were dead at the time were diagnosed with that, because we have not enough tests to check that they are actually infected with coronavirus. And if you don't practice a test for the person who is getting to the hospital, you don't add that as a cause of death. So we have pretty much a lot of people who official cause of death is not coronavirus, but it pretty much was something related to that. And it's part of the lack of tests that we are having.
Because I was looking at the statistics, the official statistics on the Google statistics page. If you Google COVID, you will get that page, and the statistics are really interesting. One thing you can do is look at the death per million people, and you have a kind of a ranking of what country has how many deaths. In the case of Mexico, it's really low, really low. It's 65 per million people, which I'm sure some were not counted. But even if there was double that, it still puts you about the level of Germany, which is also low compared to other similar countries, similar in the sense that they are Western countries. Germany is at about 100. For comparison, the US is at 250 or something like that. And France is at 422. The UK is at almost 600. Belgium is at 900. So, of course, it's not directly comparable, and you have population density, population age that play a lot into it. The US is at 300 now. And of course, things might change in the future, and I'm sure to an extent, the testing plays into it. I doubt it would double the numbers. You know, maybe there's a margin of error of a certain amount, but I doubt it would double the numbers.
Sorry, Patrick. Yes, and for example, in here, I will be really interested to see if Matthias has the number, because in Mexico, so far, we have a record of 1.8 tests for each 1,000 people. So we are, as I mentioned, one of the countries that have the lowest kind of testing. Chile, for example, they have like 8.1 tests, and a part of the official numbers that we have, at the beginning, we were using the Sentinel measurement system, which is pretty much you take a sample and you base the rest of the number on the sample. And even the subsecretary of health said, you know what? The official numbers that we have, that which are close to the ones that you are mentioning, Patrick, you should at least multiply by 8, because that will reflect the actual number that we have in here. But we cannot say that because we are not making tests.
Well, I don't know that, you know, we didn't. Maybe I'm wrong there, but first of all, Chile has 46 deaths per 100 per million. So again, that's a number you have to put in context. But I don't know that we were testing everyone that was sick. It's just at some point in that pandemic, you can decide if you attribute it to COVID-19 even without testing it. You know the symptoms. I mean, you don't necessarily need a test to tell you what kind of illness you have. A doctor should be able to make that determination. Maybe it wasn't the case in Mexico, and indeed, maybe you should multiply by 8. It's possible, I suppose. Maybe Mexico is a peculiar case. I would be a little bit wary of saying, oh, but the numbers don't mean anything. And maybe we'll need to wait for, you know, 2, 3, 10 years for people to actually sift through the particulars of each country. But do you really think that, like, I don't know. Okay, I'm not going to discuss it too much because I don't actually know. But in Germany, let's move on to Germany. How is the situation now? And more importantly, how do you think the government handled it until now?
It's interesting because I think we would be in a better situation regarding a possible second wave of the virus or like the next flu season if the current epidemic would have gone differently, because it's in the beginning of the pandemic, the government and most of the politicians listened to the suggestions of the scientific advisors almost to the letter and did all the measurements you heard about. But the longer all of this dragged on, and ironically, exactly because the spike in cases was not as severe in Germany compared to other countries, people started to question whether this was all just excessive and fear-mongering. Mm. And this is the with all these measures. If you take them and they prevent the disastrous progression you saw in other countries, the measurements seem unnecessary because nothing happened. And now you can often hear people asking, why are we doing all this shit if all the hospital beds are now empty anyway? And of course, as always, there are always those people who say, well, that's nothing more than the sniffles. You don't need any of this. So instead of being glad that we don't have 100,000 deaths like in the US, they complain that they can't eat at a restaurant and they should wear a mask or observe basic human hygiene. So I think if it's coming back, it's like they are thinking or saying maybe it'll come back in the fall with the next flu season maybe. And if that happens again, I think it will be worse because people don't take it as seriously as they probably should. Mm. And we're in the phase where everything is reopening and every politician is trying to best the other by saying we should open faster and more. And they kind of start to ignore the advice of scientific advisors. And we actually have politicians that say, or high-ranking politicians even, that say, well, we shouldn't listen to the scientists anymore because they always change their mind and revise their positions. That's nothing for us. So the normal scientific process and progress that you always observe and change your hypotheses and test them and then revise your position, that's something that politicians don't like. And of course, on the other hand, if the science advisor or scientist says changes his mind or gives a suggestion, they don't have to answer for it afterwards because they are not making the actual decisions. That's the job of the politicians. And of course, they are very scared that they might do something that seems excessive in the afterwards.
So let me ask you the question like this. Are you satisfied with your government's action until now?
Personally, I am, but I am not as critical towards the measurements in terms of that. I think they were necessary. I don't like that you have basic rights that were limited. They were never like completely canceled or anything. They were limited, but for a time, I think it was necessary. But a lot of people now would disagree with that and say that was excessive. And the interesting part is that we now have a lot some protests popping up all over the country who are protesting against all of this. But it's an interesting group that is coming together now because. Apart from the legitimate concerns about the limitation of the basic rights and the discussion about that, there are also a lot of groups like anti-vaxxers, people who flat out deny that the virus exists, the growing number of conspiracy theorists, and they're all mixing together and starting to protest, and it's difficult to keep them apart, so to speak. And the extreme right is now trying to capture this movement because they are criticizing the government, and that's their bread and butter, you know. They are jumping on the bandwagon.
So, is that pesky 5G that's causing everything?
Is that what?
That pesky 5G network?
Oh, well, it's full on. The 5G network is part of the conspiracy theory. It's funny, I was looking at... there was a comment, I think, on Twitter from someone who was... You know that Bill Gates, according to the conspiracy theories, is supposed to be the one who created the virus in order to inject nano chips in everyone to control, you know, to know their data and their location all the time and all of that. And someone on Twitter was commenting, yes, but we have phones. And all that data is already in your phones. Yes, but they could include, you know, they could inject chips. And it's like, yes, but they already have all the data because you carry a phone with you all the time. Yes, but they and could also, create, you know, it's just, yeah.
And also we should be thankful because in my time, when I was young, you had to ingest an entire floppy disk to be tracked.
Exactly. It was a lot less, it was a lot more painful.
So no one burned down the 5G tower over here like they did in England. So there's that.
Yeah, I guess there's a little bit more reason. But you seem, so overall you're satisfied, but you're concerned for what's going to be happening going forward.
Yes, especially since, a lot of the things they implemented are part of what you would consider basic hygiene. You wash your hands, you keep your distance, you don't sneeze at people. And if I hear, there was a noted interview with a theater director or something who said, I don't want to be told by Merkel that I have to wash my hands. And I'm like, if the last time I heard someone say, I don't want to wash my hands, it was a 3-year-old. So just like an adult, you know. And so there is that. And for me personally, just to put that, I'm a little bit biased because I'm part of a risk group. So I'm especially very on lookout for everything. So I have a little bit a different perspective on this. But for the most part, we need to get back to quote-unquote normal life. The thing I'm critical about is the way we're going back to it now. That's the process.
You think it might be too quick or maybe forgetting about the reason why it started in the first place? It's funny because for us, The situation is very different between France and Finland, but in many ways it's also quite similar, because the way things were implemented is very close. Mostly the same restrictions for mostly the same duration. The difference is that the spread of the epidemic in Finland was a lot lower, a lot smaller than it was in France. Of course, France is one of the most affected countries, and maybe some of it is due to the slow response or the inadequate response of the government. Maybe some of it is due to the fact that the virus was already everywhere, and we, as I said, when everyone woke up in the early mid-March, different countries were affected according to the amount of spread that had already been there. It's possible. Again, we'll see about that, I guess, in a few years. But overall, the same restrictions applied and the same level of awareness seem to have been existing in both Finland and France. But as I said, Finland had like, I don't know, a tenth of the cases, even per million. We have like 50 cases per million in Finland. And in France, it's 400, something like that. And of course, Finland is very, very spread out. The comparable part of the country is Helsinki, which is a mid-sized town. But the awareness of it was the same. And so my feeling is that most people understand what is going to happen going forward, and that we might need to get back to more restrictions. There's an awareness of it in both countries, even though in France there's a lot more complaint. It's funny because in France there are things like complaining about the masks, the fact that the masks were... I think everyone agrees that the original stock of masks from the previous epidemics were destroyed in like 2011-12, and it was decided not to renew them because the government had determined that they could order them quickly enough from China, which is why we ended up not getting enough of them, but that they could be ordered and maintaining a stock of millions and millions of masks that needed to be destroyed every few months or every year or so because they have an expiration date was too costly. And so, of course, with this current pandemic, the issue was we didn't have enough masks and we couldn't order the ones we needed for a case of pandemic because the world was going to shit and China couldn't send them. So it took a couple of months to get that situation managed. And so at the beginning, the government said, listen, you don't need masks. Just stay home. We're in lockdown. You have to stay home. Masks are not needed. And at that time, as you said, Matthias, the word of the scientific community, probably mistakenly so, was that masks don't protect you from the virus. And so they're not as useful as you think they might be. And they were worried that people wearing masks would disregard other safety measures. And so essentially the word was, we need the masks for healthcare professionals. We don't have enough. And they might have negative effects anyway. Let's not tell people to wear masks. And 2 or 3 months later, now we're telling people, actually, masks would be a good thing because even if they don't necessarily protect you from getting sick, they will protect you if you are sick from spreading the virus because they stop the spittle from spreading the virus. So now the government is telling people, wear masks, please. And you have a lot of, this is a long way of getting to the conclusion of that story, which is a lot of French people are saying, the government misled us. It didn't tell it, give it to us straight. We would have understood. We would have done what we could. And I really think that there's a, you know, vision is 2020 in hindsight situation because we all remember the rush to get toilet paper in early March when there was an unsubstantiated rumor that toilet paper would run out. and the stores were empty, I honestly believe that it would have been possible that it would have created a lot of problems if the government had said, please wear masks, when there weren't masks to give out to people, you know? So the bottom line here is the French people are revisiting a lot of what's been happening and judging it with today's knowledge, which I think in some cases is warranted. I'm sure there are some things that could have been done better. I'm certain of it. I also think some things are being judged very harshly because now we understand. You know, I very clearly remember in early March when the lockdown was implemented, I was making Instagram stories and Twitter posts explaining to people why social distancing was important, because myself, I understood that maybe, you know, 2 days before, with having had a really good explanation. I talked about it on this show. But I was explaining to people why that was important, and people weren't getting it. You know, we have assimilated this so much that we think it would have been natural back then. It wouldn't have been. So I think it's very dangerous to judge that time period with today's knowledge. But, you know, maybe there are also things that we would have understood. Maybe we would have understood that masks were necessary, but we didn't have them and it wouldn't have created problems. Maybe people would have just social distanced, even if they had made handmade masks, and they would have been prudent anyway. I don't know. My experience with the way things have gone is that people were not being careful enough already. So I don't know. We'll have the conclusion on all of this, I guess, as we mentioned, in a few years. But the bottom line is, again, third time I say the bottom line, on the overall situation now, that bottom line, I feel like things are slowly getting back to normal and people are aware that we might need to go back to a more stringent lockdown process. And that might be the difference between my feelings about the situation here in Finland and even in France compared to you in Germany, Matthias. It's that because it was quite severe and quite urgent, and we did have a lot of deaths, although not in Finland, but I guess Finns are very civilized people and understand the importance of listening to the scientists. But we're very aware that things might have to be rolled back a little bit. Just like our conservative friends were saying in the US last episode, they were like, we're reopening things. The situation is different in different parts of the country, but we know that things might need to be rolled back a little bit. But you're saying, Matthias, that this is not the feeling you're getting in Germany. People are not aware or might have a more difficult time accepting going back to a more stringent lockdown?
That's my fear. So because we didn't experience the same severity, that the next time they'll say, well, it worked last time, so why bother? It'll just work out fine. And also there's, of course, always the issue that Germany has a very large number of intensive care units compared to other countries. So even if it would hit here, the amount of people who could be treated would be larger than in other countries. So it might not be that severe in total death numbers. But the problem is, it's not just the deaths, but also it's a systemic disease. It has the aftermath, the problems you might have afterwards for life need also be something you have in mind. Because if you have a respiratory, if your lung is damaged, you will have that for the rest of your life, and that will go down on other diseases you might have in the future. But in total, I think there are 3 points why I think I don't like the way we're handling it, going back to the quote-unquote normal again. One is that a lot of this seems to be politically motivated by certain politicians, because two of the main protagonists in all of this are potential candidates for a conservative chancellor in 2021. So they're in the spotlight because they want to profile themselves and be the protector, and but also the one who champions the economy. So maybe they're not really listening to the scientists, but look more at their political profile. Number two is that I think that all of this might undermine the public opinion now towards science. Because this week there was, I think you can really call it a hit piece by a large tabloid paper on the government's chief scientific advisor. And they're trying to discredit a study he's presenting. And the problem I see with this, it was completely misrepresented. All the claims were misrepresented. They ignored all journalistic standards. Even all the scientists they quoted, they didn't talk to them. And now the scientists say, we never talked to them. We distance ourselves from all of this. But they ran with the story anyway. And I think this might... that this all undermines the trust you have in science. And if you don't trust the scientists, guess what happens the next time when they warn about a pandemic or if they discuss something else, like, for example, climate change. Well, why should we listen to the scientists? They got it wrong all the last time. So why listen to them now? And the third one is we could use all of this as a chance for change that is badly needed, especially for things like climate change. And because climate change, for example, is still progressing, we're not paying attention right now. And while all of the measures against the pandemic have done wonders for things like pollution or the reduction of emissions, we're now starting over the same way we did before, instead of taking this moment to implement badly needed changes. Just as an example, politicians over here are now discussing if we should give consumers a premium so that they can buy new cars to accelerate the sales after the lockdown has ended. But instead of limiting this, for example, to electric cars, or even if they would offer this for buying a bike or something that is environmentally friendly, they want to use it to sell the same car as before. Or another example, Lufthansa, the airline, is now getting a 9 billion euro bailout by the government because of the pandemic. But instead of using this to force the changes, they would lower emissions, for example, like they could force them. I think France did this as well. They're forcing an airline to reduce the amount of in-country flights that could easily be replaced by train rides to lower emissions. Mm-hmm. But instead of doing that, they're just giving Lufthansa the money and they can continue as before. So that's, in my opinion, a wasted opportunity.
You know, it's funny because every person I talk to on this show has bad things to say about their country and good things to say about other countries. It's always, I don't know, I feel like, certainly, I'm not saying that this isn't true, of course, but I think it says a little bit about what we choose to look at. I don't know. It's just something I notice in general. We're never happy, I guess. I don't know.
The problem is this is something we haven't faced before. It's completely new and you don't know how the outcome will be. You have no script to follow, no best practices. You're making it along as you go. And the problem is, as you said, hindsight is 20/20. If you look back, you always know that you could have done it differently and it could have been handled better. But we're all making it up along, I guess, as we go along, I guess. So,
well, I will tell you that looking from the outside, Germany is seen as the champion in the way they handled the crisis. Like, it was exemplary. And of course, there are other countries that might have handled things better, but Germany is so close to us that it's very comparable at the very least because we're cousins. So I don't know.
Also, just because you said everyone likes the other countries, but not their own. While I don't agree with a lot of things Angela Merkel is saying and standing for in this case, even though she has only limited opportunities because most of the measurements taken were on a state level or not the federal level. So she was just the, I guess, moderator who tried to keep it all together. But the way she handled this and she calmly explained everything, that's something I like about her. Even though I hate a lot of other things, that's something I really like about her. And I think whoever the next chancellor will be, I think that's something we might miss in the next one.
Oh, so at least there's a little bit of, on her way out, she gets to lift her head up a little bit more than she had been in the past few months or a year or two. Dan, I'll end with you. I guess, how do you think things are going to go for the future? Earlier in the show, you seemed to be saying that things were, as we're looking at a quieting down of the crisis here in Europe, you seem to be implying that actually things are just starting for you, even though the lockdown measures are being relaxed. You seem to say that the epidemic might not be ending at all for you in Mexico. Is that the case?
Yes, and I have similar concerns as Matthias expressed, because the second wave and the third wave will be the most deadly in this case here in Mexico. And if you check the as you mentioned before, and the official numbers that of infections that you have in Mexico, and pretty much you can look for it in Mexico in Google, you will see that they are actually increasing. So we are not flattening the curve, and we are relaxing some of the measurements. This, as I mentioned before, has to do a bit with the fact that we have to be dealing with our economical partners, in this case, the United States. If you look for the Marketplace podcast last week, they have some interviews that were very interesting, because they mentioned about the car sector in the United States and how they depend a lot in the parts that are being manufactured, that are being created here in Mexico. So that's one of the sectors that is already starting to work, because we have to we are part of this big machine where we are producing goods. So even though we are relaxing some of the measurements, the infections are getting high. I mean, well, not getting high. They are the numbers are getting bigger. So I am really worried, because if we are relaxing some of the measurements, this can get out of proportion. Obviously, this is the negative me. This is the pessimistic me. Hopefully, it will be brought in a brighter light. And I really thank you, Patrick, because when I come to the program, you always help me to perhaps get a little bit on solid ground. And perhaps it's not as bad as I am thinking, but it's just because I am really antagonistic with this government. And perhaps one final question, if both you, Patrick, and Matthias can tell me, what is the economic perspective that you have? Because at least here in Mexico, we economically weren't doing great. Actually, we were hoping for growing the earnings, the GP, but we are going to get down. And for a lot of sectors like the entertainment sector, the film sector, TV sector, well, there are a lot of businesses that if they don't open in a couple of months, they will be completely black, bankrupt. But I don't know if it's only here. It's perhaps only the perspective that I have in here. How is the economic future looking in your countries?
Well, so first of all, looking at the curve from Mexico, you're right. That gives a different perspective. It's going up, and it's up, and it shows no sign of slowing down, at least until, you know, for the numbers we have today. So I understand that it's a very different perspective when you have that size, that, I don't know, that the when the arrows are going on that direction. But economically, it's fairly grim everywhere. And the government is getting involved, especially in France, in multiple sectors of the economy to either support or help restart, because things are going to be massively problematic in the next year or so. And so I think that the way we're thinking about handling it now is that we're kind of trying to make sure we test and trace as much as possible, but the goal is not going to be to make the it's going to be to find the balance, the best balance we can, between occupying a certain number of beds in intensive care and restarting as much as possible of the economy and riding it out until we have a vaccine. And by riding it out, I mean a certain number of cases and deaths are going to be inevitable / acceptable. And of course, we are much wiser to the issues now than we were 3 months ago. And the testing is getting in place. The protective measures are getting in place. And some of the, lockdown measures are still happening. But there are things like, it's not the case in France. I can't remember where it was. I think it was somewhere in the north, in Northern Europe, that a movie theater reopened with specific measures to protect people. And I wouldn't be surprised if at some point, if the numbers keep going down, that also happens. Essentially, health is the prime concern. But the economy is obviously the secondary concern, and it's something that you can't dismiss. I think it's something people talk about a little bit less, but and it's almost a dirty thing, like in every other country. But at some point, if you can ensure that the epidemic is contained, even though it hasn't disappeared, then you have to start worrying about the economy, with the understanding, as we've said multiple times, that you might need to go back to more stringent lockdown measures if things get out of hand. But we know that we're not going to get the epidemic to disappear completely until we have a vaccine. And even then, it's going to take, 2 years to vaccinate everywhere. So we can't, it's impossible to have the maximum lockdown that we've had in the past 2 months for 2 years or 3 years, right? I think everyone will understand that. So we're trying to find that that balance, I think. Matthias, what about you?
To answer the economic question, I think that this whole thing accelerated some parts. A large steakhouse chain, I don't remember which one, like they filed for bankruptcy 1 week after they stopped, had to close all their restaurants. So in this case, there had to be something wrong with them before that. That was not just the case because of this. So it accelerated some processes, I guess, on some parts. But this morning, there was the economic forecast for the EU for 2020. And I think Germany, the forecast for Germany was -6.5% GDP. Oof. So, for the whole of the European Union, it was -7.4. So we're, I guess, a little below average, but there will be a lot of economic struggle in the next year or two, resulting from all of this. There's no question about that.
Mm. I think it's something we're all aware of, but it's not even just about accepting it. It's that people are arguing about how much we should open and how fast, but I don't think anyone, at least in France and in Finland, it seems Germany might be different, but in France and Finland, no one is saying we have to go back to normal immediately. Everyone is saying, okay, how much can we do? How quickly can we do it? What is reasonable to do? For all the complaints, and God knows, especially in France, there's a lot of complaints. I think most people agree that we can't just go back to normal immediately. And the differences are minor in the ways people want to do things, I think.
Problem for the German economy is that we're all tied to every run around us because we are a heavily export-driven economy. So if you can export into other countries, our economy tanks as well. So it's not just the way we do things, but also how other countries do things for us, I guess.
Yeah. In France as well, of course, we export a lot. I don't know how much, but one thing I do know is that a major, major part of our economy is tourism, especially in Paris. It's the most visited city in the world by far. It's like 30 million tourists in Paris every year. So obviously, this is This is to answer your questions very easily, very simply, Dan, Paris has 30 million tourists every year. So that's going to poof disappear, and it's not going to come back for years. It's not going to reach those levels for years again. So yeah, of course, people are very worried about everything.
Well,
all right. Well, thank you very much to both of you for that little panorama of the situation in all of our countries. You wanted to add something, Dan?
No, it was just complimentary, and it was well because pretty much it's the same scenario for everywhere. I mean, in Mexico, we also depend from tourism, but we depend a lot of oil, and the current administration was pretty much betting everything on oil. And you know that I believe that right now you can make more money by selling beer than by selling oil. So
you can, they don't know where to stock it. They don't know where to store it. They're paying people to buy it and store it somewhere. I mean, that might have changed a little bit already, but
they give it away for free. There was a huge news article, because a brewery who usually sells like in those large drums, not in the bottles, but who usually sells in large drums, can't get rid of all the beer, so they gave away 15,000 liters of beer because it was about to expire, and they just gave it away for causes.
Where is that, and how can I get there really fast? Because in Mexico, we don't have beer.
All right. Well, thank you again to both of you. Before we leave, Dan, can you tell us where we can find you, please?
The easiest way is on Twitter, but I am actually going to recommend that if you use Instagram, you can find me in there as Dan Campos, HDZ. And perhaps you won't find a lot of pictures, but I actually post a lot of video in there, produced content, vertical video about films, about comic books, and about science and tech. So there you have it.
Thank you very much. Matthias, what about you?
You can find me on Twitter on the account at Matzekult, MatzeKult, or you can find me on Mastodon under the same handle on the instance chaos.social.
Perfect. For me, you know what? We have a new podcast. Did we talk about it before the show? I think it was before we started recording. It's called Work in Sanity, and it's a show I do with Tom Merritt about working from home. We've been doing it for a long time. We have a lot of thoughts and advice and tips. It's just 15 minutes every Monday, so it's super quick, very easy to listen, and hopefully it brings something to your new habits of working from home. Again, it's called Work in Sanity, and you can just check it out on your podcast app. It's slowly propagating to all the podcast's apps. But if you can't find it, just go to workinsanity.net, and that will give you the URL. It will redirect to the URL you have to subscribe to for listening to the show, workinsanity.net. And for me, Not Patrick on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram as well. And of course, frenchspin.com for the show itself and the comments if you want to tell us what you thought about what we discussed. And Patreon.com/TheFiliusClub. The link is in the show notes. If you enjoy this show, please consider giving a couple of bucks, sending a couple of bucks my way, because it is, as I mentioned, a lot of work. So if you like it, I would appreciate your money very much. Thank you for listening, and we will be back in a couple of weeks with another show. Talk to you then. Bye.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.